From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, give us a call at 800-462-7413. And Zorba, along with the call, some interesting topics to talk about?
Yes, we're going to talk about food safety. When you take out food, how safe is it? How can you make it safer to make sure that what you're eating is not going to cause any foodborne illness, which, by the way, is responsible for more hospitalizations than anyone cares to even look at. And then we're going to talk about something positive about e-cigs. As you know, I have been very much against e-cigs, but in reality, there may be something positive about it. New information from the BMJ Journal that I think is critically important.
I'm out of it. E-cigs is e-cigarettes.
E-cigs. Yeah, you are out of it, though. I agree with that. There's no doubt about it.
What's our recipe?
Summer squash with basil and garlic. If you like squash, you like basil and you like garlic like I do, this is a wonderful recipe, especially good for this time of year where there is bounty on the shelf.
800-462-7413. Zorba, let's welcome our first caller, a listener with us in Muskego, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
Well, I was up late watching a documentary, and it was about a plant-based diet and basically going like a veganism type approach, and it was really inspirational. So I was trying to do some additional research, and I really found a lot of conflicting information and studies going back and forth. So I'm calling because I'd like to know what I can eat.
You want to know what you can eat.
Tell me what to eat and I'll eat it.
Hey, how about your mom? You know, what did your mom tell you to eat? Was your mom a good cook?
We did a lot of frozen meals back in the 90s, you know, frozen chicken breast. And, I mean, I think we ate pretty healthy, but it seems like, you know, the low-fat craze and there's all, you know, different conflicting things that now may not be still in the limelight. So,
you want sort of what is the ideal way you should eat in a plant-based? Do you want to be a vegetarian or a vegan or a pescatarian? I'm looking at Tom.
What's pescatarian?
Somebody who eats fish along with plant-based. What are you interested in?
Yeah, I guess it's like the optimal health, because this particular documentary that I watched, it really basically said that, you know, eating meat and dairy was really not very good for you at all, and it had a lot of very convincing people that they were interviewing, and it was just different than information that I had seen elsewhere about eating more of just a well-balanced diet.
Yeah, you know, just like the web, documentaries are wonderful. They can be well-produced, they can be convincing, and they can be wrong. And if we look at dietary fads throughout the ages, vegetarianism has always been held up as something really good. It's a puritanical diet. People sit up straight. If you eat the vegetarian way or the vegan way, your posture will be good, and you'll live a long, sweet life. For me, I think people can live a long, sweet life eating whatever they want to do. But there is an ideal diet, and it's scientifically proven, and that's a Mediterranean diet. There's no doubt about it. And the best research that I talk about all the time is 7,000 people in Spain and in other parts around Spain, a little bit of France, a little bit of Italy. 7,000 people ate a Mediterranean diet that was enriched with a handful of nuts, not peanuts, just a handful of nuts every day, or 2 ounces of olive oil, or eating sort of a low-fat American Heart Association diet. They were going to be followed for 10 years, but at the end of 5 years, actually 6.5 years, they broke the code. There was no code. They knew what they were all eating because the reduction in heart attacks, stroke, and cancer of the GI tract was 30%. Huge, huge drop. 30% of people who ate an enriched Mediterranean diet. So here you have the paleo people saying their diet is better. Okay, prove it. I don't care how much you write, how good the writing is. I don't care about how good, you know, the stuff is on the net, how good it is. The paleo diet is not necessarily good. In fact, if you take animal protein and you look at animal protein, the fact is humans started to populate the earth and have less years ago, heart attack, stroke, and became stronger when they started eating animal products. Animal products are concentrated proteins, concentrated fats that are good. Nothing wrong with vegetarian and veganism. Nothing wrong at all. But the reality is those people should not be naysayers when it comes to people who choose animal products. And the Mediterranean diet, if you look at the animal products that are used, it's fish twice a week. That's what they do, generally fish twice a week. The main oil is olive oil, which is it's still mostly a plant-based diet. If they have meat or poultry, it's small amounts that are really used to flavor things. It's not a steak. It's not a couple of bratwurst every night. And you go on the net, you look at it, and it also has moderate amounts of alcohol consumed with the food. And people who are very staunch in whatever their diet is, you know, very upright and puritanical, never talk about the aspects of alcohol, which turn out to be quite good. A drink a day with your meal actually is salutatory and is very good for you. So did that give you an idea of what to do?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I'll definitely check that out further.
Yeah, where did you see the paleo thing? Was it on a pay-per-view station or was it on a PBS?
No, it was just on Netflix. And it was called What the Health.
What the health? I love it. I love it. But if you look at dietary fads, they're continuous. They've been dietary fads. I read a book on vegetarianism, great big book. I don't quite remember the name. And it talked about vegetarianism from about the 1700s on and how it periodically rears its head as something that is better for you when people start to develop obesity. And the obesity in our society is really due to animal fats that are cheap, inexpensive, sugars that are cheap and inexpensive, and fat, and the fact that we have the cheapest calories in the world and in mankind. You know, 5% of our budget, 3 to 5% of our budget goes towards food. In France, it's 12%. They eat better, they live longer, their food tastes better, but they do not consume the enormous quantities that we do.
So, yeah. Great. Thank you.
Sure. Appreciate the call. That'd be a good name for the show. Zorba Pastor, What the Health?
Actually, that's it. We're going to change it. I like the name. Zorba Pastor, What the Health? I like that.
It'll be a steal, though, from Maurice.
Hey, wait a second. Shakespeare stole stories from others and just, you know, he was not that we're Shakespeare, but.
800-462-7413, our number, 800-462-7413. And Zorba, before our next call, take out food safety.
Yes. Well, you know, this hits the news every time a fast food restaurant gets into trouble. Do you remember Jack in the Box years ago?
Yeah, I do.
Got into trouble. They weren't cooking their burgers enough. E. coli was in there, and a number of children died, and they linked it back to Jack in the Box. Now, if you get your burger at a fast food, they check it and make sure that the temperature is high enough to kill the E. coli. And by the way, if you're doing backyard cooking on things like chicken, always look on the web what the temperature is, use an internal thermometer if you're unsure, and make sure it's at that temperature. Mm-hmm. With red meat, you're able to look at it. If it's red, that means it's rare, and if it's a burger, it means it's not cooked enough. And these are important things. But what about takeout when you're getting takeout for a restaurant? Well, if you're takeout at a big restaurant like McDonald's, I think you can assume there's a lot of food safety in there because that's their bottom line. They do not want people to get sick. But what can you do when you're actually doing it? Well, the first thing you can do is wash your hands. Now, here it is. A lot of people are just in their car. There's no faucet. I don't know about you, Tom. Do you have a sink in your car? I don't have running water in my car.
Right.
But I do actually have a hand sanitizer in my car. I have it right in the car,
really?
In the glove compartment. Well, I do because I walk the dog. And when I walk the dog, I walk the dog, I'm often walking the dog, and I'm picking up poop, and it's not sanitary. And though I'm picking it up in a bag, I always assume there may be some contamination. I go back in the car, put on my hand sanitizer. I've got a towel there in case I've actually made a mistake and I might actually get some on my fingers. Mm-hmm. It's important things. But even though you may not be walking the dog and then going to a fast food restaurant, your hands may have touched other things. So the first thing you want to do is for food safety is make sure your hands are clean. That's number one. Number two, if you're going to get something in the middle of the night and it it's not from a fast food restaurant, but we'll say it's from a restaurant like a grocery store. How long has it been sitting under that heat lamp? You know, if you're a shift worker, and there are a lot of shift workers, you ask, when was that food made? If they go, well, it was made on the last shift, don't eat it. Because if it's made on the last shift, it's really sat there, you know, sat there much too long. Because the issue is germs can actually do that. The other thing to think about are things like sprouts. Sprouts carry disease. We don't want to think about that. But the fact is, sprouts are responsible for lots of disease in there. And that's why they don't use sprouts in lots of restaurants, because you can't be sure. It's a pure product, but it can also pose bacteria. And then I want to talk for just a minute about sushi. So I was at a restaurant the other night with a good friend of mine who does not eat sushi, because he said sushi carries with it the risk of parasites. He is completely right. There is the risk of parasites in sushi. But then I looked at him and I said, what's the risk of driving to the restaurant, to driving back from the restaurant to get the sushi? And if you do the numbers, the risk of you getting into trouble is probably greater in the car, or in the wintertime, is greater than slipping on the ice, than it's actually getting that. As long as you eat sushi in a restaurant that serves a lot of sushi and knows how to handle it. So once again, you've got to know the restaurant if you're going to eat a raw product such as sushi. It's got to be made that day. It can't be sitting overnight. And if you have any questions, you ask at the restaurant or at the grocery store where you're actually picking up a lot of food. And if they don't have an answer for you, don't eat it, or eat something that is cooked that you know has been cooked recently. Those are really tips, I think, on food safety. There's a lot of foodborne illness that we're really hospitalized for in this country, and we should get a handle on it.
800-462-7413 is our number. 800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, a Parkville, Missouri listener is with us. Hello.
Hello.
How can we help?
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was calling about the effects of black mold. I live in an old house, basements just barely in one piece, and when it rains, quite a bit of moisture in the basement. I was wondering about trying to get rid of the black mold, and then secondly, what are the health effects of the mold?
Tell me, so you live in the basement, you have a window where you're living, or is there any circulation at all?
A basement door and then one window, yes, in the basement.
Yes. One window in the basement. Window closed most of the time?
Yes.
First thing to do is, especially when the weather, even unless the weather is really cold, is you've got to open that window, got to get a fan. Of course, you've got to make sure if the fan is running so bugs don't come in with that, and you've got to increase the circulation. That's the most important thing. That's number one, number two, and number three. Without circulation, you are never going to get rid of mold, because that's how moisture is. That's number one. Number two, you've got to get a dehumidifier. Do you have a dehumidifier down there?
No. Not at the moment.
That's the second most important thing. You want to get a dehumidifier that can run continuously, and that costs money. I mean, because you got to buy the dehumidifier, but then the electricity per month might be $20 a month. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, you know, they run on electricity. They get rid of the moisture down there. You want to have one that can run continuously. Put it next to a drain in the basement. Basements all have drains, you know, leaving the door open so that it can run. Otherwise, you know, you've got to change. You've got to take the bottom out of the humidifier and pour it in the sink. And if you're like me, you do it the first two times and then you kind of forget about it. So that's the second most important thing. Mm-hmm. And then if there's any way that you can keep it out, in other words, if there are leaks in the wall, you've got to get them plugged. Once again, that takes time, effort, and cost, but really circulation and getting rid of the humidity. Now, the other question is, what sort of problems does it cause? And frankly, we don't have good answers on that. I have people who have moved out of houses because they have mold in the house and they feel better. They go, I feel better. And I'll go, I don't know why. Do you really feel better? There are people that they ionize the air, because ionization of the air can take the mold and have it stick to the wall and not have it in the air that you breathe in. And they say, I ionize the air, I feel better. So there's a lot of stuff in mold that we don't understand that I think causes subclinical problems, you know, things that are not true disease. Well, I don't want to say that. Things that are disease, but we have not got a handle on yet. How long have you lived in the basement?
5 years.
5 years. So it's do you pay rent for that, or is this your house, or?
No, I own the place.
You own the place. So you rent the upstairs part? Is that what you do?
No, I don't live in the basement. That's basically laundry area and utility. It's a small house.
If you've got mold in the basement, I would get rid of it because it does go upstairs. It can affect you upstairs. And if you go down in laundry in the basement, you're going to breathe it in during that. So it's circulation with the fan. And if you can't do that because it's too cold or arduous, then make sure you put on the dehumidifier and have that run. I definitely would get rid of the mold, always, whenever you can. And even if you can't get rid of 100% of it, if you get rid of 50% or 75%, you're going to feel better. And if you can't turn on the fan all the time, at least turn on a fan when you go in the basement to make sure once again the air moves so the mold is not static.
Okay, thank you.
Sure, appreciate the call. Before we take a quick break, Zorba, how about we let one of our listeners give us a piece of her mind in a segment we call Disagreeing with the Doc.
Disagreeing with the Doc.
The following email came to us from a listener named Catherine in Random Lake, Wisconsin. She writes, "Dear Dr. Pastor, you recently used the, I guess, medical term, ovarian failure, when referring to menopause. I want to take issue with that terminology. A more accurate term is ovarian completion. Think about it, Zorba. When you got your medical degree, it was because you successfully completed your coursework. The university did not consider you a failure because you were no longer taking classes from them. I submit that a woman who has gone through menopause has completed her stint at repopulating the planet. Have you ever wondered how that makes a woman feel when she is diagnosed with ovarian failure as opposed to ovarian completion? Failure is such an emotionally defeating word."
All right.
She continues.
I won't use the word.
It's time to update that male-centered terminology.
That's right.
Other than that, you'll want to hear this. I am a faithful listener and enjoy all the good advice I've gleaned from your program.
How wonderful. Well, maybe we should just make it men. You know, when men stop producing testosterone, we'll call it testicular failure. Or we could use other terms that are not mentionable because we're on public radio and they'd be beeped out. But there are other ways to do it. The DSM-10, which, of course, all of us know about. You know what the DSM-10
is. I don't have a clue.
Right, of course. Well, that's... Sorry, Tom, if you don't have a clue, I can't explain it to you. But these are terms that we use for billing the federal government when we're actually doing something or for actually making a diagnosis for statistical purposes. Uh-huh. And that's the term that's used. It's called ovarian failure versus ovarian completion. But once again, we can call people overnourished. We can call them overweight. We can call them obese, or we can call them fat. And they're all different terms that mean the same thing. The proper polite term, which is called overnourished, which is a gentleman at one extreme.
Whoever says that.
Well, I put it on there. There's a diagnosis of overnourished. If you say somebody is overnourished, it has a different import than if I'm sitting in the office and I tell somebody you're overnourished. And if I tell somebody you're obese, if I tell somebody you're fat, they all have different meanings. And the reality is if I just say your BMI is too high, they all have different meanings. And we all know exactly what's going on at the same time. But to be polite, to put this to bed, I promise to try to never say, on my scout's honor, and I was a Cub Scout for 1 year, to do my duty and try not to say ovarian failure. Mm. I will say menopause. Yeah.
I guess I'm undernourished, huh?
You are undernourished. There we go. That's right. You are not thin. You are not skinny. You are undernourished.
Do you think Zorba is a complete failure? Just post on our Facebook page or send us an email.
It is not fair. Zorba@WPR.org. Or, of course, Facebook.
Our recipe coming up next. More of your calls, of course. Another topic to talk about. Right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Come talk with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number is 800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, unfortunately, a squash recipe.
Unfortunately? Really, what do you think the squash, if squash had consciousness, what would it think about? You like that, wasn't it?
Am I insulting squash?
It was like if a tree falls in the wood and no one hears it, Zen koan.
It would get back at me by being
on
my plate.
That's right. No, it would cause you nightmares. That's it. It would consciously go in there and zap you as nightmares. But, you know, there are a lot of squash lovers in this country. And every time you say you don't like squash, you are insulting people who are squash lovers.
I mean, think about that. No,
they're going to come up against you.
People.
That's right. I mean, people like squash, they're going to take umbrage with you. They're going to say, I'm not listening to the show because Tom doesn't like squash.
Gee, we're losing audience.
We're losing audience.
Oh, boy, a squash recipe. Let's do it.
That's it. Well, this is a good squash recipe. If you like squash. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't eat squash till I was in college. In fact, I didn't know what it was. I looked at it because, did your mother ever serve squash?
No, I never had squash.
What did your mom serve for vegetables? Corn?
Yeah, meat,
boiled
potatoes,
corn,
and vegetables.
Boiled corn. Yeah. Green beans, wax beans, lima beans, peas in the can, which are disgusting.
Oh, no, spit out.
Lima beans. My mother would serve lima beans, butter beans, anything in a can she would serve or frozen. But she didn't believe in fresh food. Other than lettuce and tomatoes. I don't think we went beyond that part of the vegetable counter. I think because all of a sudden her hackles would come up and she was afraid to even look at the squash. That's what I think. My mother had fear of squash. Your mother probably had fear of squash too.
No, I don't think so. She just didn't like it
she
much.
Didn't like, and that's why you don't like it.
Like mother likes it.
Like that's you got it. How about basil? Do you like basil?
Let's do the recipe.
Okay, summer squash with basil and garlic. I'm trying to get you interested in this.
I'm excited. I'm more than interested.
I can tell. All right,
let's do it. Failed.
For summer squash or zucchini, and if you want to, you could actually use a spaghetti squash. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard of a spaghetti squash?
Okay. I think you've mentioned it before.
Yeah, right. That's about it. Okay.
Four small summer squash or zucchini.
That's right. Or spaghetti squash. Mm-hmm. Two teaspoons of extra virgin olive oil.
Two little tea extra virgin olive
Four
oil.
Four big tea of fresh basil.
Four big tea fresh basil.
Two medium garlic cloves pressed. Pressed.
Two medium garlic cloves pressed.
I've clearly been drinking too much. Yeah. That's exactly it. 1/4 cup of grated fresh Parmesan cheese.
1/4 cup grated fresh Parmesan cheese.
I got to get through this recipe.
Okay, we'll do it.
Okay, you want to make the squash into long strands. So you do that with a Julienne presser, one of these little things that will make the squash into long strands. Spaghetti squash will also do it. I can tell from your face that you've never heard of something like this, but
no, it's interesting to me.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
There's an implement.
There's an implement that actually makes it, and it makes spaghetti like strands of squash. And spaghetti squash actually, that's what spaghetti squash looks like, and it's a wonderful alternative for people who are gluten intolerant because it's squash, and obviously squash is gluten free, no wheat in there. You can use a peeler to make this with a noodle like strand. So heat olive oil in large skillet. Add the squash strands and the garlic. Cook it for a few minutes until it's slightly softened. Add the basil and continue cooking for about 30 seconds to a minute. That's all. Mm-hmm. Very quick. You're really sauteing it. Add some salt and pepper to taste. Then take the squash and take with the Parmesan cheese. Put it on top. Toss it and immediately extra Parmesan on the side for serving. And basically what you're making is you're making summer squash or spaghetti squash that looks like spaghetti with Parmesan. It has fewer calories. Calories are minimal, like 94 calories versus probably about 250 calories to 300 calories for the same serving with pasta. It's good for people who are gluten-free or just gluten intolerant. Mm. It looks good. It's a wonderful thing to serve kids to get used to squash because it looks like spaghetti and it sort of has the texture of spaghetti. And parents have a big problem getting kids to eat different textures. Mm-hmm. It's often a problem. And if kids look at it and it looks familiar, familiar, then they'll try it. Mm. And so I think it's a very good, simple recipe. And for people who haven't taken this down, they can come to our website.
Let me write this down. What's that website?
Zorba. Nobody writes things down, Tom. They put it in their smartphone. Zorba. We're getting rid of script. Remember? They're not even going to teach
this?
It.
What is this I'm holding?
That's a pen?
That's right.
That's right. ZorbaPastor.org. That's ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget Facebook.
800-462-7413, our number, 800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hey, how are you doing?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, I'm a 55-year-old man, and I've raised some boys, and they're all athletic, having a great time in life now, but I, unfortunately, over the years, gained some weight and decided now it's my time to get back in shape. So I started some of the traditional things, got to the health club, got on the treadmill, started lifting a little bit of weights, and 6 months later, I decided that I looked at the scale, I gained 8 pounds. So I'm actually going in the wrong direction. The consensus I kind of figured out is that I need to increase my metabolism or something of that nature because I'm going the wrong way on the scale. And they said, well, you're putting on muscle. I don't think I'm putting on that much muscle. So checked around, and there's 100 different recipes out there for increasing metabolism. I don't know which one's a good, bad, or in between, or kind of stuck as to what to do at this point going forward. I think a lot of people in my age bracket kind of experience the same thing.
I'll tell you exactly what to do. You got to eat less food. That's what it is. It's calories, calories, calories. Let me give you some backstory for it, first of all. So my son was over the other day, and I like making homemade ice cream. I've got an ice cream maker, and I'm going to make Nutella as one of it. I just made a wonderful gelato that was made with cherries, and we like that. That has fewer calories than ice cream. So we looked at Nutella, which is what I like, and 2 tablespoonfuls of Nutella is equal to 30 minutes of running on the treadmill. That's what it was. He said, no, 20 minutes. I'm sorry. He said, if I have 2 tablespoonfuls, I got to run for 20 minutes. If I have 4 tablespoonfuls, I got to run in 40 minutes. We were looking at it. It is a highly concentrated food stuff. I mean, it was much more concentrated. And I thought, what does Nutella have? It has oil, and it has, it has oil, and it has sugar. And, of course, it has chocolate, and it has flavoring. So you did not put on 8 pounds of muscle mass. Let me assure you, unless you lifted weights and became a wrestler, it's not the case. It's like people who say, well, I'm big boned. I mean, come on. There really is no such thing as big boned people. There are people who are overweight, overnourished, and fat, but there are not big boned people. So the problem is we have calories everywhere. Now, we lose 1% of our muscle mass from the age of around 30 on, somewhere around in our 20s, every single year. So if you're 50 and you go to the same weight that you were when you were 20 and you look in the mirror, you don't look the same. You still hang. I mean, I went down to my college weight, and I looked in the mirror, and I thought, I still have love handles. Well, I didn't have love handles when I was in my 20s, and that's because fat has replaced the muscle weight. I never had a six-pack ab, but I didn't have the love handles that I have now when I'm at the same weight. So when you're actually exercising, you're not using your muscles as much. You don't have as many muscles. So part of it is metabolism. There is no doubt about it. So you've got to stop feeding the body, and that means you've got to look at calories. And there are 10 million diets out there, but basically people who exercise tend to eat less, and then you've got to look at what you're eating and know what you have. You've got to Google the food to see where the calories are coming from. You will be shocked at what they come from. If you look at salad dressings, Paul Newman regular ranch or regular Caesar salad dressing versus light, the light has half the calories of the regular. I mean, so in other words, if I use regular Paul Newman Caesar, I'm getting twice as many calories. So you've got to look at what you're eating. That's what you have to do. How much do you weigh? What's your height? What's your weight?
5'8", 256.
Okay, so 5'8", 256. So you are getting, if you actually do a count, if you do 3 days, write things down, don't look it up. Every time anything goes in your mouth, you write it down. If you weigh that much, you're probably somewhere averaging around 2,800, 2,500 to 2,800 calories a day. Not every single day, but that's what you're going to average out. And if you want to get down to your proper weight, it's 2,000 calories. That's about it. 1,800 to 2,000. And you would be surprised how quickly you can get to 2,000 calories. You don't need to eat much to get to that weight. That's what you got to do. You want to be down. What was your weight when you were 21?
I did a lot of wrestling, like you said, wrestling, weightlifting, football. I was probably, I was very muscular, 195.
195.
My running weight probably, if I trimmed off all the muscle at that junction, 185.
185. So 195, you were a muscular guy. How much, when you did push-ups, how many push-ups could you do?
Anywhere between 35 to 50.
How many push-ups can you do now?
Three if I'm lucky today.
Three if you're lucky today. You could get to 10 to 20, but you should shoot. I wouldn't shoot for 195. I wouldn't shoot for that weight because that's kind of beyond where you may be able to get. But I bet you could get to 225 within 6 months if you looked at the calories that go in. I bet you could get that. And I bet at that point you could get to 8 to 10 push-ups. I bet you could do both of those things. So I am of the concept now of go slow, shoot low. In other words, don't shoot to take off a lot of weight. Shoot for that 10 and 20 pounders because then you can actually get there, make it reasonable, look at everything that goes in your mouth, and you could reach your goal. And you know what? You'll feel better. So you've said you've got how many boys do you have?
Five.
Five boys. Any girls?
No. That's why we have five boys.
That's right. So I have a question. What did your wife say when she found out the fifth child was a boy?
At that point, you kind of threw your hands up in the air saying, this isn't going to happen.
I've got to calculate. I can't calculate out the number. I think one of our listeners is going to send in the number by email of odds are of having five boys in a row. But it's an enormous number, and I can't remember my math. But it's a very, very big number. So, well, congratulations, and I'm sure you had quite a busy household. So
okay, I appreciate that.
Good luck.
Yeah, appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. And before the break, Zorba, let's break out your robe and gavel for another episode of Judge Zorba. Where's that gavel?
No, where's this music? You know something?
No, we don't have any.
No, I understand that. That's your next thing.
Music for this one.
You've got to have no music for this one. You've got to have music.
Are you ready? Today's case comes to us from Gerald in Madison, Wisconsin, who writes, "My wife and I are fighting over changing to all softened water in our home. Our city has generally hard water, and I have a home with softened hot water and cold hard water. My faucets and other surfaces accumulate deposits of calcium and other muck at a high rate. It's
muck.
A hassle.
Other muck.
But my wife says all water being softened will be unhealthy. So who's right here?"
Well, I'll tell you what. First of all, in many ways, the wife is right. Bang, and I'll tell you why. There's no doubt. I mean, I usually kind of waffle on this. I've been accused of changing my mind, back and forth. I'm not going to change my mind in this. Do not consume softened water. Why? Because it has salt. It has sodium in it. We do not need the sodium. So when it comes to cooking and drinking, you don't want to have softened water. The difference, by the way, with hard and soft water is hard water has calcium. Soft water does not have calcium, and it's an exchange mechanism within there. Everyone knows it because when you soften water, you put what in the water softener? Salt.
Yeah.
So if you drink the water, you are drinking salt. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a no-brainer to realize that. So basically, what you want to have, because we have hard water in our house, we have a water softener, our kitchen sink and the kitchen and the bathroom on the first floor, the cold water is not softened.
Mm-hmm.
We look at the bathroom upstairs, the water up there is softened. The hard and the cold water is softened. So you want to make sure you're cooking water and drinking water. Now, occasionally, if I brush my teeth or if I actually want to drink a glass of water upstairs, I'll drink the softened water. But frankly, it doesn't taste very good.
Mm-hmm.
So wife one, husband zero.
Have a debate you need settled? Add your case to Judge Zorba's docket by sending us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
More calls to come, of course, as well as another interesting topic, and we'll be quack, quack, quacking up with Dr. Zorba, all coming up on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. 800-462-7413, our number, 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, here's a study linking e-cigarettes to reduction in smoking.
Right, right. And as you know, Tom, I've been pretty much against e-cigarettes mm-hmm. because, number one, I'm not sure what's in them, and I still don't know what's in them because, as far as I'm concerned, there's no certified way of knowing that the e-cigarettes are, quote, safe. They don't have toxins in them like heavy metals. Mm-hmm. Number two, I'm concerned about kids and e-cigarettes. Teenagers are trying e-cigarettes, and is this a gateway to tobacco? We don't have the answer yet to that, mm-hmm. so I'm very concerned about them. But this is a positive study on e-cigarettes for smokers that I think is really worth paying attention to because e-cigs are here to stay. In most states, it might be throughout the country, you can't get them under the age of 18. And I think the kid mm-hmm. thing can be answered by the right education and some other issues. So they look, this was a survey published in the BMJ Journal, a very prestigious journal, and they looked at five different population studies to see what role e-cigarettes played in smoking cessation. So in total, the survey was read about 160,000 people in the survey. Roughly 22,000 were current smokers. A number of them were recent quitters, and they wanted to see what the quit rate was. So first of all, e-cigarette users were more likely to try to quit smoking, to try to quit, than non-e-cigarette users. So 65% of the people who were using e-cigs tried to quit smoking. In other words, so if they were current smokers and they used e-cigs versus about 40%. 40% of the current smokers said, I'm going to try to quit smoking. 60 over this period of time. But two-thirds of the e-cigarette users, you know, who are still smoking said, I'm going to try. The rate of cessation, 8.2% of the people who used e-cigs succeeded in quitting smoking versus 4.8% for the people who didn't.
That's not just quitting cigarette smoking, but quitting e-cigarettes.
No, they didn't. The survey had nothing to do with whether or not they continue smoking e-cigs. The survey had to do whether or not they quit tobacco. So in other words, roughly 8% of the people ended up quitting if they were using e-cigs versus roughly about 4.8%. Now, that may not seem like a lot, but that 3% difference carried on for the number of smokers in the country, if everyone did this, would be about 300,000 people additional people that would quit smoking.
But this doesn't say anything about e-cigarettes.
It says nothing about the safety of it, but it does say one thing. It says for people who want to quit, e-cigs may be useful as long as they actually work on quitting and not just work on reducing tobacco. So I think it's something else that we doctors have to consider when we're telling people to quit smoking. E-cigs may be part of our recommendation.
800-462-7413 is our number. Question for Zorba, 800-462-7413. Back to the phones now, Zorba, a listener with us in Omaha, Texas. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for putting me on your show.
Sure. How can we help?
I'm having problems with my diverticula, and I had my first infection in 2015, and then this year I had diverticulitis with an abscess.
Oh, wow. That was awful.
And they always told me, you know, don't eat anything with seeds, and I have been so careful, and I have an organic garden, and I take the seeds out, and I'm still having their problems. So I was hospitalized just recently with that abscess, when they're discharged me. They said, I can eat anything.
Right.
It's a myth.
That's exactly right. The seed thing is a myth that we doctors perpetrated for about 100 years. Mm. That if you have diverticuli, don't eat seeds. And it turns out that was wrong. It was probably old Dr. Gustafson back in 1920s. He did some surgery and found some seeds in a diverticular abscess and said, you know what? The seed's the problem. And it turns out that is bulky junk. The seeds are not the problem. The problem has to do with these little pockets in the colon. And frankly, you're much better off with a high-fiber diet.
I am. My husband used to call me my fiber queen. I was raised on fiber. I love
the fiber queen. Yeah. I love it. It was a nice term of endearment. I love it. The fiber queen. Well, you are. So is this your first episode that you had, or did
it's
you have
the
other?
Second. The first one I had in 2015, mm-hmm. I was taking chemo.
What were you taking chemo for?
Marginal lymphoma.
How are you doing?
I'm doing good.
Good, 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 good. I would continue being the fiber queen. That'll work out well for you. You're right. You can have all the seeds, so you don't have to do with that reduction of seeds thing. And sometimes you'll have an episode or two. The real issue is sometimes to step in with antibiotics very quickly if another episode occurs.
Yeah.
So you've got to talk to your doctor, because a lot of people who have diverticulitis have antibiotics on hand. And they know when the symptoms start, and they often will go back on the antibiotics with their doctor's sort of permission and guidance.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you've got an episode on Friday afternoon and your doctor isn't back until Monday, you might not call up and you might suffer over that time.
Right.
So.
I love your show, and I said, I'm going to call because I know when his Dr. Sorba will tell me.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for listening. Really appreciate it.
I thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And we appreciate that call at 800-462-7413. Okay, Zorba, let's dive into the murky waters of medical quackery. Let's fire up another segment of Quacking Up with Dr. Zorba.
Quack it up.
Okay, Zorba, most of us have heard of snake oil, but tell us about fat-reducing soap.
Wonderful. Wonderful. This is absolutely wonderful. It was called La Par, I'm sure I'm not pronouncing. French name, you know, if it's French, and the French are beautiful, it must be good. Obesity soap. And it's convenient. It's safe. The obesity soap, you've got to understand, it's used like ordinary soap. So you wash it with your body, positively reduces fat without dieting, get this, or gymnastics. Gymnastics. So this is a 1920s thing.
Wash your belly
That's right. It would get rid of obesity. Without gymnastics, I love it. Instead of exercise, they call it gymnastics. Absolutely harmless. Very true. Never fails to reduce flesh when directions are followed. Send for a book for testimonials. Now, here it is. Box of two cakes sent prepaid. So, in other words, they prepay it. Yeah. I love it. Prepaid. For $2. Okay. So, I looked up what $2 was during the 1920s. $2 was equal to $50 today. So, in other words, for $25 soap or for $50, you can get obesity soap. Think about how wonderful it is. I'm a little fat. I want to be just a little fat around my belly. I'll just use the obesity soap, and it'll melt away the fat of my belly. Or my cheeks. I want my cheeks to be down a little bit. I'll just wash my cheeks. And when they show the picture, it's not a picture. They show a woman with long hair, sort of done up a bun in a bun, and she looks absolutely beautiful.
She's using that soap.
She is using La Parle obesity soap.
Do you have an example of medical quackery to contribute to this segment? Just send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
Back to the phones now, Zorba. Listener with us in Maryville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dr. Zorba. How are you today?
Good.
Fine. How can we help?
Well, I'm 53 years old, and I've got gout, and an inherited trait is I don't necessarily like taking a whole lot of medicine. And two questions I have. One, if I take the cleansing medicine, are there any long-term ramifications? I think one of them is allopurinol and maybe colchicine. And secondly, is there a diet that I might be able to adhere to help prevent the attacks from coming?
Oh, sure, sure. Well, let's talk about the diet first, because for the most part, the diet is worthless. I want to tell you about that.
I thought you had to give up some.
Not at all. And any doctor who says give up the stuff in your diet is crazy, unless you live in Nova Scotia and you're eating lobster and shrimp every day. Are you eating lobster, shrimp, and crab legs every day?
No, sir. Actually, swore off of that a long time
ago. How about liver and onions? You eating that every day, liver and onions?
No, I don't.
No. So, you know, what happens is if you paid attention, it's uric acid. It's a uric acid problem. Either you're overproducing or you're under excreting. It doesn't really tend to make a difference. But if it's a uric acid problem and you go on a low uric acid diet, you can drop it about 1 point. You know, the normal is about up to maybe about 8, and maybe you could drop it to 7.
If I was given the choice, gout or liver every day, I'd choose gout, I think.
Well, you're in good place. You know, Benjamin Franklin had gout. Louis XIV had gout. They did not have access to the medications that we have. The medications are really, really good. So the first thing I would recommend is allopurinol. It's a wonderful drug. Allopurinol is great. It changed the course of gout. It's cheap. It's a generic. It's worked. It's what you would call a cleansing drug. It doesn't actually get rid of the uric acid in your body, but what it does is it gets rid of the uric acid production in your body. And over time, people tend to excrete the uric acid they have. So that's what you would call the cleansing drug. But when you stop taking it, then gout tends to recur. How often do you get gout flares?
I'd say once a year.
Yeah, so
9 months to 12 months.
What a lot of people do, first of all, especially if they also have tweaks, is they take allopurinol every day. They think of it as a vitamin. It reduces their gout. And for many people, they stop having flares. Literally, they stop it dead in their tracks. They never get flares again, or if they get a flare, it's a small amount, much better than colchicine. Colchicine is a completely different drug. So, first of all, allopurinol, drug of choice, I would say 99% of the people tolerate it. They take it every day. Now, what do you take when you have a flare? What do you end up taking?
Indomethacin.
Okay, indomethacin. So let me tell you, old drug, good drug. Let me tell you what tends to work as well as indomethacin. Ibuprofen, plain old-fashioned ibuprofen over the counter, but twice the dose that's on the package. So since you're not always at home where the indomethacin is, what you do is, let's say you go, I think I'm getting a gout flare. As soon as you say, I think I'm getting a gout flare, you start attending to it right away. You don't wait until it gets worse. You go to your local convenience store. You look at ibuprofen, and all you have to remember is double the dose that you see on the over-the-counter bottle. And that works as well as indomethacin. I have to tell you, I know a lot about this because I did gout research on a drug called Euloric. Full disclosure, I worked with our foundation at our office, and we did get paid for doing that research. But I know a lot about gout, and I have to tell you, allopurinol, cheaper than the name brand Euloric, this other drug, works 95% of the time, and then ibuprofen works for your flare, and you can then eat all the liver and onions you want.
Well, I sure appreciate it. Been waiting for an opportunity to talk to you about it, because not many doctors I trust anymore, unfortunately.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Glad we could help.
I love your show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, and thank you so much for that call.
Absolutely wonderful comment.
At 800-462-7413. And before we sign off, Zorba, we love it when our listeners chime in with helpful information or interesting ideas. The following note came to us from Steve in Wethersfield, Connecticut. He writes, Dear Zorba, it's not enough to list added sugar on a food label. In reality, added sweetener should be listed, which would include artificial sweeteners and natural sweeteners not classified as sugar. This will let me know how sweet the item is, because as I get older, I don't want things so sweet anymore. We should also have a sweetness factor, some kind of indication as to how sweet an item is. Before you respond, Zorba, I've been getting older for a lot of years.
You have. You've been getting older for a long time.
I've noticed more and more sweet stuff, not less and less sweet stuff.
That's right. You've noticed that. There are a couple of reasons why people often want sweeter stuff, by the way, as they get older. But I want to comment on his comment.
Yeah.
He's right. We ought to have labeling that says any added sweetener that's in there. But, you know, when it comes to food labels and recommendations, there are a lot of hands in there. So in other words, you've got food processors. It's not scientifically based. It always comes up with a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And right now, it should be added sugars and sweeteners. And good luck on doing that. But public outcry often makes changes like no trans fats. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't just the feds coming in there. It was public outcry. So good point. I love the point. As you get older, you don't taste things as much because your sense of smell also drops by maybe 0.5% a year. And so what happens is old folks, well, we don't say that. We say people who are at the termination of their life, the ones who are about to expire. But as they get older, they like things that are sweet because we change it. We taste it with our tongue. Sweet, salty, bitter, and sour. You taste with your tongue, and cold and heat. So people often like their soup, their food super hot. They feel like they can taste it better because they like the sensation. Yeah. And they like ice cream because it's cold. They like ice cream because it's cold and it's sweet. And they don't taste subtle flavors. So, Tom, you're following the pattern of your age.
I'm like everybody else.
You're like everybody
Every other old guy.
Every other old guy. That's right.
Have a sweet tip for Zorba. Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org, or you can find us through Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen. Our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll join us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0805Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at zorbapastor.org.